Here we will be starting off. Michael and myself will be talking about the flexibility of the economy and making money different ways, such as Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, Grubhub, things of that such nature. We're starting mid-conversation, so hey, grab something to drink, grab something to eat, and come on and tune in. This is a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it.
Do Uber or DoorDash because they need the flexibility and they need to be able to make their money in 3 days a week so they can build their business. So I think there's a lot of factors going on there. And if nothing else, a lot of people got a break. So if you're exhausted and starving and in survival mode, you're just, you know, thinking one day to the next. So you're not thinking, can I get a better job? You're just thinking like, how do I get to tomorrow? And then the government gave you some money, gave you a little breathing room. And you have to think about like, wait a minute, what the heck am I doing? Why am I here? I can do better than minimum wage with it. Mm-hmm. And you know, you take a minute to look around. You're like, oh, look, they're paying $18 an hour. Oh, they're paying $20 an hour. I'll go over here. You know, Amazon's much maligned warehouses start at $17 an hour.
Yeah. I believe Amazon drivers are making just a regular local delivery guy mm-hmm. that deliver the door to door. I think those guys are making $22 an hour right
That's
now.
That's right, yeah.
To be honest with you, I remember before the pandemic, a lot of people that I knew that's what they were screaming and crying about. Making 22, 24, 21. Remember, most jobs were making 15, 16, 17. Mm-hmm. You know, once you get up in the 20s or whatever the case is, you're doing maybe just a little bit better. Not off mm-hmm. the wind, but, you know, you got a little more leg room. So, you know, I think, you know, in a time like now, I do know there has been a million new entrepreneurs mm-hmm. starting their own businesses and stuff like that. I also know that, like yourself also, I've done Uber and Lyft, and I've even tried, what is it? Not DoorDash. What is the one when you go shopping for Instacart?
Instacart. Yeah.
Yeah. I've tried that. I wasn't the best.
That's not the one for me, but
yeah,
I've heard great things about it. That's just not the one for me.
I heard some people that it works for, but
yes.
It's a very finicky system. Which, I mean, hey, you know, you got to get into the mind of a person that's shopping.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
I've met people who love it. They swear by it. And I get why they do. You know,
yeah.
If you're that kind of person, you're like, hey, I got a list and I'm going to go pick up all the things. But, me, I'm like, I want to sit. I like Uber over DoorDash because I get to sit in the car and never get out.
Yeah.
And
I would do Lyft. I used to do Lyft in Uber. I would do it for 12 hours a day.
Yep. I've done that.
Buku money. Buku money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember one day doing Uber or Lyft, I can't remember, but I was doing it. A guy got in the car. He was from LA. He was going to the airport. I met him all the way up in like Westchester, Ragnar area, or whatever the case may be. And I heard him close a $24 million deal in the back seat. Like literally, it was crazy because we started talking about it as we were on 476 on the way to the mm-hmm. airport. And it was like literally, like, heard the whole conversation, the full conversation, got the context behind everything, and also heard the, I don't remember the numbers, but remember the numbers for the wire to go through for the deal that finished and be complete. So it's crazy. Like you say, you get a plethora of all kinds of people. So we have a question already, so we just want to kind of jump back and forth. So this young lady, Yvonne Holloway, she's a very good girl. We call her Vita. She asked the question, what do you think of the new variant of Corona?
So I think it's too soon to tell if it's going to be a big deal or if it's going to go the way of Lambda and Mu and some of the others. Because it all depends on if it can outcompete Delta.
Uh-huh.
Basically, if it spreads better than Delta does. So it's entirely possible that it will end up being nothing. It'll be disruptive still because people are going to panic. They're going to change their plans. Anything with long lead time, you know, conferences and whatnot.
Yeah.
Someone who's about to like, okay, I'm going to plan my conference for June of next year. Oh, wait, no, now I'm not going to plan it. So travel industry is going to be affected and there's going to be some ripples. I think if it does turn out to be like a new Delta, as in a new thing that spreads a little better, avoids a vaccine a little better, I think that what we're going to see is what happens when we don't respond. Because we may have mask mandates, people are going to ignore them. Because I think people are to the point, and in some areas, you know, in Portland, in New York, a couple places, they're going to respond, you know, they're going to lock back down and respond. And in other countries like Austria, they take it very seriously. But I think in most places in America, that especially the South, the Midwest, parts of the Northeast, the people are just going to go, I've had enough COVID. I'm done with COVID. And we're going to get to see what COVID, you know, basically what the vaccines alone with no other mitigating factors can do against COVID. Because I think a lot of people are just to the point of I'm done with this virus. And the virus isn't done with you, but they're done with the virus. So they're going to go back to traveling. They're going to go back to their events. They're going back to having parties. And you know, with Delta, we had some areas where the hospitals were filling up and overflowing and people just went, meh. So, I mean, unless we actually get to the point of like the body bags stacked in the streets, I think one of the big mistakes they made in 2020 and the healthcare industry or the health, public health folks, they don't really think about public communication and they should, but so they were all about safety. You know, what's the safest thing to do? So we got to keep everyone out of the hospitals, which means no reporters in the hospitals because that's dangerous. Can't let anyone near it. Mm-hmm. Well, what that means is you didn't have the evening news full of video of people on ventilators. You didn't have the evening news showing the trucks that New York City had lined up as morgue trucks because their morgues were going to overfill. And all these different things that if you had visuals of them on the news, people would have gone, holy crap, this is serious. Instead, there's no visuals. Mm-hmm. You know, as they say on the internet, picture it didn't happen. And there was no images of that. We've all seen the movie. You know, we've seen Contagion. We've seen Outbreak. Like, what does an outbreak look like? Well, it looks like there's bodies in the street and there's people blood running out of their eyes and cars crashing into telephone poles and blackouts and planes falling out of the sky and you know, people slumped over their steering wheels dead in traffic. That's what an outbreak looks like. And we didn't see any of that. So people said, I've seen the movies. This doesn't look like the movies.
So they didn't take it as serious.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at least you see a couple people with a breather, you're just walking down the street, you know, something to get your attention to make you say, holy crap, this is a big deal, and not just, eh.
I think that's probably one of the biggest downsides of us as Americans, mm-hmm. is that, you know, we don't know fire is hot until we put our hands in it. You know, we believe that, yeah, it's flickering, but we don't know what being burnt feel like. Until we experience it.
Yep.
So I feel like that's a countrywide thing.
Mm.
You know, I think it is cross-cultural. It's it doesn't matter what you see. The one thing about this virus that has been taught to us is that this virus don't care about your status quo.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. It don't care if you're poor, if you're broke, if you're middle class, if you're upper class. You know, it doesn't care your color, white, black, Puerto Rican, Asian, whatever, mm-hmm. you know, all the nations we have here under the U.S. flag. It really doesn't care, bless you. It really doesn't, the virus don't care about really who you are. Because if it's able to do what it needs to do, it's going to attack you just like it will a 10-year-old or a 95-year-old or whatever the case may be. So I think that one of the things that we probably need to try to do as a nation, and another thing, I feel like the people who make the rules, if you will, the people like who run the CDC and things like that, I think they need to do just a little bit better with when they, you know, I would rather you wait a little longer to tell people what to do or what not to do. Than to like, it seems like, you know, we're trying to catch this thing because we haven't dealt with nothing like this in a long time.
Yeah.
So we don't have damage control. So America doesn't do well with trying to catch up and get in front of something. We're normally up in the forefront or can cut it off before it gets too crazy.
Well, I think we're also, this is again where movies have taught you wrong about how science works because people are seeing science unfold in real time. And so, you know, in the movies, the scientist does their thing and they research and they say, aha, it is 7. That is the answer. And in real science, you do a study and you get a result, and then someone tries to reproduce the study and gets a different result, and then someone else reproduces it and also gets a different result, and you realize the first result was wrong. And then you study something else, you get some more information. Because, you know, there's no machine to, like, look at somebody. You can't put somebody's body in a machine and say, okay, you have 23 pieces of COVID. Or even, I mean, at first, until they do some fairly advanced tests, they don't even know that it's a virus. They just know people have some respiratory illness. You know, is it a virus? Is it a bacteria? Is it radiation? Is it a fungus? Is it, you know, there's no easy way to tell that until you send things to a lab. And because, you know, you can't just, like, take their lung out and put it under a microscope. And even if you could, that usually tends to be fatal to remove parts of people and put them under microscopes. But yes, science is really nitpicky to figure things out. And there's things like the vaccine. If you want to figure out how it works, you have to give a bunch of people the vaccine, give a bunch of people not the vaccine, let it run out for 6 months and see what happens, to see how effective it is. So it's not as simple as, like, oh, vaccine, 93%. All right, that's good. And so, you know, for example, the original thing about, was it, you know, wash your hands, you know, the standard flu and cold response is what they first said, because that's what they knew. You know, mm-hmm. Wash your hands, don't touch your face, clean your surfaces, all that. That's because they didn't know anything about the virus. They were guessing viruses in general. And then they said, okay, what we learned about this virus is this. But, of course, you've got reporters who probably didn't pass high school science or got a C in science. They got an A in makeup and a C in science, and they're trying to report on what the scientists just came up with, but they're conflating it with something they heard last week from someone else, and something else they read, which is actually a 4-week-old study or a 4-month-old study, and then people say, scientists don't know what they're talking about. No, reporters don't know what they're talking about, so you don't know what the scientists are talking about. The scientists get it, but, you know, you're totally right that the CDC, again, they're not a messaging organization.
Very true.
So they're thinking, okay, we got to get out there with the newest science. We got to have the newest. And instead, what they need is a steady hand. And of course, you know, our previous president didn't have a steady hand at all because he was just, but you need leadership that says, okay, based on what we know, we need to do this, this, and this. And we are learning more. And so we're going to do this. And they need to accept that, yeah, you may wait 2 weeks to do something and that may cost lives, but it will gain compliance. Like in our area here in Southeast Connecticut, They threw a mask mandate in, but our governor, who has the spine of a jellyfish, and it's not political, it has nothing to do with his party, he's just spineless, whatever party he's in. I voted for him because I didn't like the other guy. I liked the other guy less. But, you know, in this situation, our spineless governor said, I'm going to let the towns individually decide if they want to have a mask mandate. Which, there's some good leadership. Mm-hmm. And so some towns threw out a mask mandate and announced it through, I think, posting a sign on a bulletin board somewhere. And nobody knew. And then you cross, you know, here in Mystic, Connecticut, downtown Mystic is divided by a river. It's Groton on one side and Stonington on the other. Groton has a mask mandate, Stonington doesn't. Most people don't know Mystic's not the same town. So you cross the bridge and the rules change.
Okay.
And so, of course, there's no compliance. Even if people want to follow the rules, they don't know what they are. So, yeah, you definitely need to, you know, you need to take a minute and figure out, okay, what is your strategy? And what can you accept? You know, Australia, they said, we have a zero COVID target. China is the same thing. So they will accept no cases. So you got a case in the city, you lock down that city for a week. And everyone gets it. Because the payoff is, once we've done that, you don't have to wear masks because there's no COVID here. And then if we discover a case, boom, we're locking down again. Other places might decide, yeah, I think it was Sweden decided, we're just going to let it run its course. Let it happen. The economics will be too bad. Let it run. Okay, that's what they decided. But then there's not the trade-off. They have the economic benefit and, of course, you know, the health costs. America, we're like, yeah, we kind of want to control it, but we kind of don't. So we'll kind of lock this down, but then let this run. And those people can come over here, but those things can open and, you know, these people are going to be locked in their houses, but those people are going to have parties every Friday night. And it's worst of all possible worlds because there's no strategy. There's no leadership. There's no agreement on what is acceptable. You know, how many deaths are okay. At a certain point, you decide, okay, we can't contain this. You know, 30,000 people a year die of the flu. Okay. You know, that's 10 times the number that died on 9/11, but you accept it because the cost of locking down the flu is too great.
Yeah.
I mean, we could eliminate the flu the same way we took care of COVID. We just have to lock down the country for 4 weeks every November.
Uh-huh.
It'd be a little expensive. But, you know, we need to decide, like, hey, what's acceptable? How much are we going to control this? What are we going to do? Because otherwise you get some people doing everything right, keeping their masks on, staying home, not meeting their friends, not seeing family to keep it controlled. And other people just going, la-da-da-da-da, doing whatever they want. And then they're free riding. They're getting the benefit. They're getting the benefit. When I was staying home all last year, I was helping keep it under control so that some Yahoo could go off and hang out at the bar all night. And
very true.
I don't think that's fair. As the guy who stayed home, I guess the guy at the bar probably thought it was fine.
Yeah.
But
hey, some people don't, you know, feel like they have a responsibility to society no matter what's going on.
But I see a question.
Yeah. So Yvonne said, do you think the vaccine works? Because people with the vaccine still are getting affected with COVID.
So the vaccine does work. You know, the vaccine does work, but no vaccine is 100%.
Very true.
I mean, just like, do you think seatbelts work? Because some people still die in car accidents. Also, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is garbage.
Mm-hmm.
That's my scientific opinion. So what's funny, if you look at the efficacy numbers, and I'm confident the tens digits, not the ones digits. So I'm going to say 60-something. So a single shot of Moderna and Pfizer, you get about 60-something percent protection, which means your chance of catching it, like if you're in a room with someone, you have a 60-something percent lower chance of catching it.
Of contracting it.
Johnson & Johnson, after one shot, gives you a 60-something percent protection. Pfizer and Moderna, after your second shot, gets you up to about a 95% a month later. And then over time, it drops down into the 70s or 80s, I think. And then the booster gets it back up in the 90s and apparently keeps it there. Of course, they haven't seen that yet. So Moderna and Pfizer, 60-something percent after the first shot. Johnson & Johnson, 60-something percent after the first shot. Now, Johnson & Johnson, you can get a booster after 3 weeks. Remember, it's a one-shot routine. But you can get a booster after 3 weeks that will get you up into the high 80s.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds a lot like a two-shot regimen. So making everyone get a single Johnson & Johnson shot and positioning it as this, like, oh, this one's easier, was as irresponsible as if they said that Pfizer and Moderna were one-shot regimen.
Yeah.
So a lot of the people, especially early on, I'd hear someone get a breakthrough case, like, oh, yeah, I got my shot, but I got COVID. Which one did you get? Johnson & Johnson. And in the spring, everyone I talked to who had a breakthrough was Johnson & Johnson. Later on, you know, Delta evades I think Delta pushed it down to the 80s. So with Delta, with Pfizer, Moderna started getting it as well. But you know, Johnson & Johnson, they just didn't even – it wasn't even the right regimen. Fortunately, I think only less than 10% of Americans got J&J. But so because they're all grouped together, you hear people are getting COVID after they got the vaccine.
Yeah.
Which one? I don't know. We don't keep those numbers separately. Just people. And so then people say, well, the vaccine's not working. Also, the other thing is that people who have the vaccine don't die, which if you don't like dying, the vaccine is positive in that way. I mean, you can get it bad enough you wish you would die, but it's less likely. But the death rate of vaccinated people is nearly zero. I think if you exclude immunocompromised people or people who are have some sort of condition, like healthy people don't die if they've had the vaccine and catch COVID.
Yeah.
the measles, mumps, polio, all those are 80, 90 something. You know, that's why if you get a tetanus shot when you cut yourself, because your tetanus vaccine no longer has sufficient efficacy to keep you from getting tetanus.
Very true. Very true. So let's weigh the conversation over to a more unhealthy but healthier conversation. So according to NBCDFW, that's NBC It's basically the place that does a lot of the college news and things of that sort of nature. Just to state the source, if you ever want to look it up, is NBCDFW.com. Says that 45% of college grads are unemployed. And 53% of that are recent graduates. Is this a issue that's way out of control, or is just the cost of the times?
That is not a statistic I'd heard. And it doesn't sound right, but not knowing the source, I don't know. I mean, it's because, you know, with the hiring boom on, I know one of the big issues is people out there who are looking for jobs. Like, you would think with this labor shortage, you could just go out and get a job. You could walk into a place and be like, I'd like a job. And they'd be like, come on in. Here's your apron.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
And there are places like that. There are plenty of places that have like interview today, work today, hire on the spot. You know, if you're Dunkin' Donuts, what are you doing? A background check? Sending them to Coffee University? You hand them an apron and say, start pouring. So a lot of these places do interviews on the spot because what are they waiting for? But a lot of the places are still running people through the rigmarole of like, oh, go to the website. I heard a story of a guy. He went to a live job fair. Stand at the table, talking to the recruiter. And they say, okay, yeah, it seems like a fit. Yeah, it seems like a good job for you. Oh, yeah, I think I'd like this job. So what's the next step? Go home. Go on your computer, go to this website, and fill out the application. Why am I at a job fair?
I could have just stayed home and did this.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think that's common, but there's certainly plenty of companies that still, they put people through an hour-long application process. And,
yeah, that sucks.
And I think the assumption is, well, I want people who are dedicated, but how can I be dedicated? I don't know anything about the company. I don't know if I want to work for you. I haven't done an interview yet. So it's kind of like, you know, do you want to marry me? Well, we haven't had a date yet, so should we do that first? Yeah, why don't you decide if you want to propose? After you do that, then we can go on our first date. And then I'll decide if I want to marry you.
Uh-huh.
Wait, what? And so I think that's part of the problem. Yeah, I don't know about it. So I will say that, well, for some people, college is great. You know, especially if you've got to be an engineer, a lawyer, a doctor, a social worker, something that requires a degree. But for the average person who's just saying, I want to make more money, college is one of the biggest scams going. You know, if you go $200,000 in debt to make more money and you come out and you make an average of $10,000 a year more, and now you're making $45,000 instead of $35,000 a year and you're still barely at subsistence level, but you've got a mortgage without a house, you got screwed.
You got screwed.
You got screwed because they don't teach you what you need to know in college. Yeah. Now, again, if you're going to be a doctor, they teach you what you need to know. They teach you how to be a doctor. And they do teach you useful things, but they don't teach you what you need to know. They don't teach you how to network. They don't teach you how to negotiate a salary. They don't teach you how to manage your taxes, how to invest, how to any of those things that will actually make you, you know, get $200,000 of value. And I've realized this over the last year because I'm in the coaching world. Yeah, business coaching.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of great coaches who have programs that are between, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. Those are called high-ticket programs. If you got $200,000 to spend in education, you could buy 10 of these programs. And most of them promise, you know, that your business will make $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. You could buy 10 of these programs. You only need two of them to work. The other eight could be junk.
Uh-huh.
If two out of eight work, you now have a six-figure, seven-figure business. So compare college to that. $200,000 to party for 4 years and maybe learn some stuff and get a piece of paper that might get you a job but probably won't, compared to a coaching program that actually teaches, we're going to teach you how to build a high-ticket program. We're going to teach you how to run a summit. We're going to teach you how to launch a profitable podcast. We're going to, you know, one of those. At least they're directed towards making money.
Absolutely.
College, you talk to them about like, well, I make money on this. Well, it's about education. It's about being a real well-rounded person.
Uh-huh.
Cool. But so, I want to be well-rounded, you know. So far, the well-rounded I see is the round zero in my bank account. Because, you know, I've got a job paying $19 an hour with a degree. What the Or you drive Uber, which you make $30 an hour, but you don't need a degree for that.
I remember maybe 2017 or 16. I remember when I started doing Uber or Lyft for part-time money, supplemental, income. And I met a guy just waiting. We were waiting at the airport. He used to make you wait in a lot for your next ride, if you will. The guy told me that he had his master's and was working on his doctorate, but he can't find work. But he just felt like he might as well finish since he went on this far. He was like, I'll probably be in debt until I die because of my student loan. I said, that is crazy. I think school is not for me. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking about going to Penn University. That's a college here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, just to get my cybersecurity certification. I work in security field. Mm-hmm. So I'm only doing that for means of survival if I'm going to stay in the workforce. Mm-hmm. But I'm not doing it because I have a passion. I just know I can see the way of the times. And it's more so, this is not a degree, it's a certification. And
yeah, that's continuing education. Yeah,
that's all you need to work for Google, whoever. If you can... Like you said, network good enough and talk yourself into a job, then this is all you need to do it. So why do you think school is always like shoveled down so many people's throats? But just like you just said, like you end up with a big zero in your account and debt on your credit, on your name, on your credit and stuff like that.
So I think there's a few reasons. One is, of course, the higher education industry is an industry that people make money off of, and so they promote it. And legitimately, well, in the past, college was the path to better jobs. But I think also college was, there was a correlation and causation. There was a correlation between going to college and getting a better job, not always a causation. Because if you come from a wealthier family, and they're better connected, and they teach you can be anything you want to be, and that you can, make a lot of money, and you work your way to the top, and hard work has rewards, and then they send you to college, and they pay for it, or you pay for it yourself, this was in the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, when you could pay for it yourself.
Yeah.
You come out with all those benefits, and also college was a networking space, because there were fewer colleges, and so there were these alumni networks, and it meant something to be able to go to other alumni from your school, and you could leverage that to get jobs. And so, yes, everyone who was doing this had a degree, but the degree didn't do it. The connections you made at college did it, and the kind of family that made you go to college did it, and having a wealthy enough family to pay for college did it. So when they just started pushing people into college who didn't have the family background, didn't know how to network, didn't have the confidence, didn't have the belief in themselves, didn't have all those things, all they had was a piece of paper. And they discover, oh, this piece of paper doesn't do anything. And it doesn't, I have a degree. I have never used it. I can't think of one place in my life where I can say, were it not for my degree, I couldn't have done this.
Wow.
Like, it has opened zero doors for me.
Kind of like a prime example of, it's not about what you know, it's who you know.
Right. And over in 2014, I moved to this area. So the way I got to be the guy who was a guy was I moved to this area knowing nobody, jumped into networking with both feet. I went to, I went to chamber events. I went to ribbon cuttings. I went to anything I could get to, started making connections and became fairly known. And then when I gave up on the starting the business idea that I was kind of half-assedly doing, I needed a job. So I just got one. Like, went to someone in my network and said, hey, you're hiring, right? Cool. Can I work for you? Okay. Boom. Job. And I didn't like that job anymore, so I got another one. I don't want to work there anymore. I want to work for you. Boom. Job. And then I didn't like that one either. So I really shouldn't work for other people, so I work for myself now. But most of these jobs, I just went network to network. Introduction.
Could you dive into networking a little bit? Maybe it might be someone on here that that know the word but don't know the mechanics of it.
Yes.
Like how you really get into it.
Yes. Yeah, so actually, just to the finish that story, and I'll get into more of the how I did it.
Yeah,
so I live in Southeast Connecticut, small county, 250,000 people. Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods are here, so you may have heard of the area, but it's not a bustling metropolis. Ambitious business people don't stay here. They go to New York and Boston or at least Hartford. So it wasn't a big pond to be swimming in. Pandemic hits, and all of a sudden everything goes online. Every networking organization that's meeting in person is now meeting online. I can go to anywhere in the world. So I started going to BNI groups, that's Business Network International, and in, you know, just playing around, going to Malaysia, going to Australia, going to, you know, Canada, England. England was tough because BNI meets first thing in the morning, so it was 1:30 a.m. local time. Only did that one time because that was a rough time to be at a meeting. But so I started going to all these different things. I started discovering these other networking events. I hosted a virtual summit. I went to an event called Strategic Alliance Live, which actually is running again starting tomorrow. And that like completely up-leveled my network because I met more millionaires in that event than I'd met in the previous 10 years. Wow. And you know, these are coaches, entrepreneurs, even people running 7, 8, 9-figure businesses. And normally they network at events where it's a $5,000 ticket. And so it's just people like them. And what they were finding was meeting with people like me who, you know, didn't have $1 million business was still valuable because I could be a connector, or I could be a client, or I could be, you know, so the people who weren't in their space were still valuable to connect with. So their business is richer for getting more diversity through the internet, but it's really democratized networking. So as to how to do it, the first step in networking is realizing anyone you need to meet, whatever it is you want a job, you want to learn something, you want support, you want guidance, somebody has that answer and you can find them and they're willing to talk to you. That's key. They're willing to talk to you. So, you know, if you're watching this and you're a 16-year-old kid who doesn't have two nickels to rub together, you know, doing their homework by candlelight because you can't afford electricity. If you can get in touch with a successful coach, a CEO, someone out there, if you can somehow make the connection and say, hey, I'm a 16-year-old kid. I'm broke. I'm living in you know, the worst part of Philadelphia, but I want to make something of my life. Could you give me advice? 9 out of 10 successful people would say, yes, I'd be happy to help you. Now, again, they may not get the message. So, you know, you email them, they don't email you back. Well, they probably didn't get the email. It's not they're like, stupid kid. It just, not all messages actually arrive, as we probably know. But if you can get in touch with them, they're often happy to help because almost every successful person had mentors. So they all feel an obligation to help people who come after them if they reach them. Now, if you talk to their secretary, if you talk to their employees, if you talk to people around them, they'll say, they don't have time for you. But if you can get to them, they want to help. And people, you know, want, and also you don't need any particular person. There's thousands of people who can help you. You just have to figure out what type of person can help you. What I did when the pandemic, when I started going online, I knew I was going to start my own business. I thought it was going to be coaching, like straight business coaching, turned out to evolve. And I started knowing what I was doing and then realized I didn't. So I'm like, hey, I know I'm doing my own thing. Now I don't know what the focus is. I don't know who my market is. I don't know. I know what tools I have. I don't know who wants to buy them. And I just started talking to people and just started having meetings, having conversations. And every one of them gave me a bit of advice. Some of it was bad. Most of it was good. It was all one piece of the puzzle that brought it together. And eventually, you know, I've had over 600 networking conversations over the last year and change.
Wow.
And through that, and you know, and some of them, I'm talking to these people, and I know these are $1,000 an hour coaches, $2,000 an hour coaches, and I'm just having, you know, a one-to-one, get to know you, virtual coffee, whatever you call it. As opposed to, like, one of them was 30 minutes on the calendar. And as we get into minute 60, and we're still talking, and I think there's something else on my calendar, I'm like, I don't care, because I know who this guy is. I'm going to talk to him all night if he'll keep talking to me.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he just kept, you know, giving advice and asking questions and giving answers. And there's so many people out there who are eager to help.
Okay.
but you have to believe you can do something better. This is one of my greatest frustrations. So many of my friends, they're making $12 an hour, $13 an hour. They can barely pay their rent. They're struggling to get by. And I can look at their situation. Now, some of them, maybe they have a physical disability or they have some kind of challenge that really holds them back.
Okay.
But so many of them don't have anything holding them back except mindset. They believe that they see themselves as a minimum wage worker. That's what they are. And, you know, for example, in our town here, I've met with a division manager of our local Taco Bell. And our local Taco Bell has a growth track. So if you work there and you want to move up, you can be making $50,000 a year after, I think it's 6 years, if you hit all the promotion marks.
Okay.
Yeah, you'll be a general manager. Now, you're working general manager's hours, you'll be working, but you're making $50,000 a year, which is pretty good if you start at $13 an hour, which is minimum wage in Connecticut.
Absolutely.
So I talked to someone who worked at the supermarket, and they're like, yeah, I don't really like this job. They don't treat me that well. They pay minimum wage. Minimum wage went up. They still kept me at minimum wage. They just bumped me up that way. And I'm like, you know, at Taco Bell, they'll hire you tomorrow, and they've got this growth thing. They're like, yeah, I don't know. I'm like, what don't you know? I mean, unless you hate working with food or something. But you know, I can give them that lead, and they'll say, eh, I don't know. Just because they don't believe anything's better.
Do you think they don't believe anything is better, or do you think they think that something like that, a lead like that, is beneath them?
No, well, I mean, this is someone's working at a supermarket. So,
oh, okay, all right, yeah.
No, it's not like I was at suggesting a less prestigious job. I wasn't saying, like, quit working at the bank, go work at Taco Bell.
Yeah.
But I think what's happened, I've seen this happen with people, is they tried taking a chance once and it didn't work out.
Okay.
You know, I tried changing jobs once, and the second job was worse, so I should never switch jobs again unless I get fired. you know, I tried starting a business once. It didn't work, so it's not going to work. Where, you know, look at the any Silicon Valley billionaire, they failed three times, and their fourth business hit. And, you know, same thing. I mean, depending on how you count it, I've failed countless times. Dozens? Hundreds? But each one was a step. I saw it all as a step on a path to get to eventual success. You know, I bought a house last November where we've got savings in the bank. We got, you know, things are going pretty well now, but there's a lot of failure leading up to that.
Uh-huh.
But I never looked at it as, oh, it failed. It's okay. This one didn't work. Let's try this one. No. Okay. Let's try this one. Well, let's try this one. And I think a lot of people, and of course, you know, when your friends and family around you are saying, and this goes back to, you know, what I was talking about, those reductive messages we see on Facebook. When your friends and family around you are like, capitalism is rigged and the billionaires have everything and nobody can get ahead and you know, the only thing we do is burn down the system and we need a revolution. Well, what's the point of getting a better job if you're planning on a revolution next week? But unfortunately, revolution's not coming. Well, fortunately, because revolution never goes well for the poor people.
Never.
Like, find me any revolution in history where the poor people came out on top.
Any book I've ever read with war strategies in it, revolution does not end well.
Yep. Yeah, and because it's usually what happens is the middle class displaces the elite.
I was listening to a podcast actually earlier today, and it was a podcast about investing. And funny, they talked about what someone predicted, and they said that in the next 5 years, it's a good possibility when the whole bubble bursts, if you will, the economy goes down, we will probably end up in another war and possibly a civil war.
Mm.
Do you think you can see that happening in America in this day and age?
I hate to say yes. So there's a couple podcasts I've been listening to because that's how I absorb my history now, because books are hard. books take time, so I listen to podcasts and books on tape or audiobooks. And so actually two, both by Mike Duncan, that I've been listening to. One is called Revolutions, where each season is a different revolution. This is the first three seasons, which is English Revolution, French, and American. And also History of Rome. Which starts at the founding of the city and goes all the way up to the fall of Rome, I think. I've gotten as far as the rise of Augustus. And So, you know, in most of these revolutions, there's a locus of activity. You know, in the French Revolution, it all happened in Paris. The French Revolution really developed steam when the States General, the Assembly, whatever it was, moved from outside the city to inside the city. Because once they were in the city, the mobs could start having an effect. In Rome, of course, everything happened because everything happened in that one city. And I was thinking about that compared to America. In America, we'll have an issue happen in Minnesota or Kenosha or Dallas or Los Angeles. And the thing is, you could have riots and burn Los Angeles to the ground. It wouldn't fundamentally affect the functioning of the government. The closest we got to any kind of insurrection affecting the government was January 6th, when you had rioters actually invade the Capitol. But even there, we have enough rule of law that even if you seized the Capitol and seized a number of Congress people, you still probably couldn't take control of the government. Now, if you have the president on your team, then that's a whole different story. But you know, if you're not already inside the government, then it's difficult to physically seize the government. And there's enough, you know, that deep state they talk about, the bureaucracy, just kind of keeps doing its thing, and it's spread out over a really wide space. Now, that said, we could still certainly have conflict. And there's, you know, you see the priming for it already in the social media messaging, priming far right people to think of far left people as inhuman, and far left people think of far right people as inhuman, as enemies, as I always look at it as like, if someone were directing this, you know, pulling the strings of both sides, which wouldn't be hard. All you have to do is have some kind of team that makes memes and create some troll accounts and just kind of slips the message in there.
And now again.
It's, you know, they make 100 memes, 20 of them go viral. And yeah, it doesn't take advanced psychological knowledge to be able to look at the state of Facebook and say, okay, what's going to go viral with hardcore left people? Okay, this will go viral. And I bet they get a 50% success rate at making a meme and getting people to adopt it. And so what I'm seeing, which I give about a 40% confidence on this prediction, but what I'm seeing is that we have the right talking violence. You know, Gates was spreading the video of AOC being executed and Kyle Rittenhouse taking a gun and shooting someone, which actually is another interesting topic we might get into if you really want to stir the pot. But so the right saying, like, we need to defend ourselves and we got guns and guns, violence, let's blow things up, which might make you think the first shots be fired by the right. But my prediction is the first violence will come from the left. Because, so you, again, this imagine some puppet master, mm-hmm. probably Russia, pulling the strings. So you get the right to basically point their guns at the left and say, we're going to shoot. Well, once someone said that to you, now you're thinking, I have no choice. I have to fight in self-defense. And thus you trick them into thinking that they're in mortal danger and that, you know, their liberty is about to be taken away. And the hyperbole on the left about, I mean, you know, the where they talk about abortion rights as if they are, you know, fundamental life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness type rights, which, you know, abortion rights are very important. But if abortion was completely banned across America, the basic level of freedom we have would not change. There would be profound downstream effects, and it would be important. But it's not like, you know, giving the government the ability to eavesdrop in our house, which we do with our Echo Dots and Google Homes. But you know, but it's not like that level of. But they talk about it that way, and everything that you see the left talk about is a mortal issue. You know, and the issues aren't actually that big, so they're being inflated. So you combine the talk of violence from the right and the everything is life or death on the left. And I think the first shots will be some kind of If I had to guess, I'd say a bombing from the left. Because the left doesn't like guns.
Yeah, they don't like guns.
So they'd use a truck bomb or something.
Very interesting yep. perspective.
And then, of course, once violence has started, then you have people... Because, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse, as far as I can tell, I think we had his name, right? Kyle mm-hmm. Rittenhouse? Because a lot of people are like, what was he doing there? Well, to his mind, he was told, hey, there's this mob of angry revolutionaries, rebels, coming down the street, and they say they're going to burn everything down. Uh-huh. Last night they did some damage, and today they said they're going to finish the job. We need your help. And so we want you to come out and just stand between the mob and the property to protect. We're going to give you a gun. Of course no one's going to get hurt. You're just going to stand there with a gun. They're all a bunch of wusses anyway. They'll see your gun. They'll run away. Liberals are afraid of guns. They'll yep. see your gun. They'll run away. Nobody will get hurt. It's just a show of force. And he's like, okay, I got to be big patriotic American. You know, he's a 17-year-old kid. Yeah. He's so excited to finally be the big man, the white knight. He shows up. They hand him the gun. He stands there. And then, of course, somehow he gets separated from the crowd, separated from his people. Someone starts picking on him as a target. Maybe starts threatening. Maybe he was in danger. Maybe he just got scared. But, you know, you poke a guy with a gun long enough and you get him scared enough and you're going to have an incident that's not going to go well for you because the other guy has a gun.
Yeah.
And then you chase him and beat him with a skateboard until he shoots you. Yeah, that's – I'm pretty sure most people in that situation wouldn't just be like, oh, guess I'll just try not to die here. Oh, wait, look, I have this firearm. Maybe this will solve the problem. But so you take that mentality of the there's these bad guys. They want to cause damage. They want to cause chaos. I need to protect it. You add that to violence actually having occurred. So some – it only takes one wacko to create a bombing. Yeah. You know, one whack job gets a bomb, blows it up, boom. And now you've got people from the right say, oh, we need to protect the things. I'm going to take my guns. I'm going to hand my guns out to my friends. We're going to protect the things. And then you get places across the country where people on one side who are armed rub up against people on the other side who are armed. And it's a matter of time, especially if there's agent provocateur, someone actively saying, we think gunfire in the streets is good for our interests. Those are probably not Americans, although they could be Americans, by which I mean they hold citizenship, but I wouldn't call them Americans, who do something to light that powder keg. And then... from one bombing incident, you end up with a running firefight in the streets of Minneapolis or Duluth or Austin or whatever.
So let me ask you this. This is going to get controversial. Mm-hmm. So obviously Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted of all charges and no slap on the wrist, got free to go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I would like from your perspective... to know is if Kyle was Mario, if Kyle Rittenhouse was Raheem Rittenhouse, whatever.
Yeah.
Does the verdict go the same way, or does the situation even happen the same way?
So I'm definitely happy to go that way. I think there's kind of two questions. One is the justice for people who aren't middle-class white people, which mm-hmm. is an issue. And the other was the verdict for Rittenhouse correct? So I think the verdict for Rittenhouse was correct. Now the question is, would the verdict for Raheem have also been correct? Mm. And that is hard to say. I mean, because certainly in some places it would not have been. It depends on the jury. You know, Raheem probably would not have gotten, $2 million of fundraising for his defense fund.
Wow. Very true.
Although it might have been, if it had happened in that kind of situation. Flip the situation completely. You've got a neo-Nazi rally in a black community, and then, you know, last night the neo-Nazis burned down one store, and credible threat, they're going to come down and finish the job. And a black man comes, he says, I'm going to take my gun, I'm going to protect this business, ends up shooting someone in self-defense. I think in that reverse situation, you would see the public support and you would see the public fundraise. Because that's part of it, okay. Is that people of color don't have the money. They can't afford the $800 an hour lawyer for 1,000 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, Kyle Rittenhouse had the best lawyers the money could buy.
Yeah.
Because he had, I've got a dog nosing me here. you know, he had the best lawyers money could buy because he had so many donations that he has additional money in his legal fund for if there's civil cases.
Wow.
Like there's, I think it's like $800,000 left. It's a big number. I don't remember what it is, but there's a lot of money left over. So yeah. Much was donated because mm-hmm. people saw this as the flashpoint. I think flip, there would have been a lot of money donated on the other side because again, it would have, if it had been that kind of case. So that's why it's a really exceptional case. It's not just some guy, you know, if Kyle had just been some guy and it hadn't been a national thing. If he'd had a public defender, even a middle-class white guy with a public defender probably wouldn't have gotten off, because he wouldn't have had the resources. So that's one of the places where it's often class rather than race. That said, you do still have the issue of the bias that, if he ended up with a mostly white jury, because it's, I don't know if Kenosha is a mostly white town. I imagine it's because Wisconsin, but you know, if you had that kind of situation where it was say a mostly white jury, and because there's all these bias factors. I know there've been all kinds of studies where they'll show, you know, a face of a black man, a face of a white man, and be like, what words do you associate with them? Or, you know, the facts of the case are like, here's his face. He claims it was self-defense. And here's what happens, and exactly the same thing. One's white, one's black, and people say the black one wasn't self-defense, the white one was. So there's certainly, there's definitely an issue there. So it's, there's a couple different issues I think at play that mingle together, which make it so complicated to talk about the Rittenhouse case because it was a big case, because he raised a lot of money, and so he had the best lawyers. He was also white. He also, I think, had a white jury. And, you know, but then on top of that, he also, what he did was legally self-defense.
Yeah.
So there's that factor as well. So the issue isn't, should he have been acquitted? It's, are there people of color who are being convicted? And there are. And, you know, there's all kinds of things I saw on Facebook, which I completely resonate with, which was, you know, there are a number of, there are a number of women in jail who killed their abusers who would like to have a word with you. Like, if you have an abusive spouse, abusive boyfriend, and, you know, they're beating you on a regular basis,
yeah.
And then one day you build up the courage to stand up to them and end up killing them, but, you know, because he was just using his fists and you used a firearm, it's not considered self-defense because it's uneven response.
Uneven response, yeah.
Even though last time he used a bat. But this time he's just using his fists, so the law only considers that single event.
Justify.
And the other thing is some states, the blue states generally, have the obligation to flee.
Yeah.
So what can happen there is the victim...
And I think, sorry to cut you off, I think that was a big point in the Rittenhouse case, because in the state that he was in, that was kind of like, if you have the ability to flee, then that's your first job. So mm-hmm. with him running away, he was justified to end up using deadly action because
yep.
he showed that he ran away from danger. And
right.
then he executed lethal force when he was attacked.
Right. But at the same time, you know, if you're being attacked in your home by your partner,
yeah,
like where are you going to flee to? The woods?
It's a very good point.
And then what do you do when you're done? But right. if the strict letter of the law, because the self-defense laws aren't written for domestic violence. So if you're being attacked, and so that's one of those places where the unintended consequence of the way the law is written causes injustice. Those are easier to fix than things like jury bias and not having the money for good attorneys and those kind of things. Because that's a matter of – but that also takes political will to be able to take action.
Yeah.
And to realize, like, this is a problem and needs to be solved.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So yeah, it gets to be, and that's also, you know, talking about how big the country is. The good thing is I don't see the country being swept up in general civil war. I see a city going into unrest, or possibly a region. Mm-hmm. But I don't see like armies roaming the countryside and states breaking away necessarily, because they're too intermingled. But that we also have 50 states with 50 sets of laws.
Yeah.
And so something happens in Wyoming. And then, of course, you get the what I call the thermostat in the other room effect. Okay. Have you ever been in one of those houses where, like, there's a thermostat in one room that serves two rooms? And so you open the window in the room with the thermostat, and the room without the thermostat is now 97 degrees because the heat kicked on in both rooms.
Okay.
I think you get that, like, something unjust happens in Wyoming. And someone in New York looks at it and says, oh my God, that's terrible. We need a law to make sure it doesn't happen here. Well, you've already got a law to make sure it doesn't happen here. So you pass another law. And so Wyoming is still very unjust. And New York goes until it is way over the edge in the other direction.
Yeah.
And that causes other problems because you're not looking at where you are. You're looking at, you know, national image and then doing local response. And, so, and this is also, you know, we get the problem of reductive reasoning. Is, you know, when you conflate these things together, you get a mess of, of, you know, how do these things, you end up responding to the wrong thing.
Very true, very true. So, as we get ready to wrap this up, this is the kind of question I like to ask people, depending on whatever their background is and things like that. So I normally ask this question, but I word it differently in the beginning of the show, but I'm going to end it with you.
Flip it around.
and I know it's going to be a vague question, but hey, answer it the way you feel. But where do you see the country in the next 3 to 5 years? What does America look like to you?
3 to 5. That's a short horizon.
I'd say 5 to 10 then. Give you a little vague room to stretch.
Let's see. Where do I think we're going? So I think it depends on a few things, you know, the way a few things go. Unfortunately, the systems I see seem to be towards division.
Okay.
Because so much is happening on social media. When people talk to each other face to face, they find common ground. When they talk on social media, they find radicalization. So I think we're gonna see two things happen at the same time, and I'm not sure they're gonna interact. One is what I said. I think there will be I think we are going to see violent conflict of some kind. I don't think it's gonna be armies marching around. Because I think we have enough rule of law and our military is enough committed to peace and order that I don't see anyone taking over the army, which would be necessary because, you know, the army can, like, kill you from space. So you build an army and march it out into Wisconsin, they can just, like, kill you from the air. Yeah. And that's the end of your army. Have a nice day. But I think that we will see some sort of conflict probably in the cities provoked in some way. Could be caused by the left or the right, or each one will think the other one caused it. I think at the same time, there will be a growing movement to counterbalance that of people who see through it and say, wait a minute, we're actually all on the same side. We all basically want the same things. Like, okay, we disagree on abortion or we disagree on gun control, but we all believe in peace, love, justice, liberty, all these American things. We all love apple pie, except if you don't love apple pie, but that's okay. We love apple pie type things. So I think there's also going to be a growing movement of people trying to bridge divide, try to do things like, you know, your show, have long form intelligent conversations, delve into issues, discuss differences of opinion, without creating unnecessary acrimony. And I think we're going to see both of these running concurrently, and it's a question of which one ends up getting more influence. And I think the tipping point of it will be if someone can find a way to make that concept of getting along profitable, because conflict is profitable. You know, Fox News talks about conflict, makes lots of money. You know, another news station talks about people getting along, nobody tunes in. So if if you can come up with some sort of news platform that people say, oh my God, this is, it feels real. It feels like real news, but it tells me America is actually a good place and fundamentally full of good people. Oh, I like this. Yeah, I want to watch this. I think that that would be the, so there's going to be those two competing forces, the forces of the entropy or yeah. Entropy. Yeah. You know, pulling us apart, tending towards chaos, and also, for lack of a better term, the power of love, trying to pull us back together, saying, you know what, we're actually all pretty cool. Let's see if we can get along. And those two forces, I think, will be playing out against each other. And I just keep going as it's been going. And you know, I think we're also going to shift over the next few decades from being the superpower to being one of the powers. And we're going to have to kind of get used to that because we're stepping back on the world stage. So we're abandoning our superpower role. And that's going to open up all kinds. It becomes very dynamic once there's more players in the game. So I think it's going to get interesting. Yeah. But I don't see, you know, gangs roaming, you know, roaming the countryside. I see us becoming like England. You know, England used to be top of the world. Now they're just one country among many. I think that we'll be, and you know, we're a big country, so we're always going to be a big player just because we're physically huge. But I think it'll be, you know, us and India and China and Europe as more of a collective unit. And it'll be a multipolar world again. And, you know, we'll, it won't actually affect the average American all that much, except that we'll not feel as excited about ourselves.
Okay, well, there you have it. Listen, Michael, I actually really enjoyed this conversation tonight. Enlightening, getting to get to see things from a different perspective. I'm glad we actually stuck to this and we did it. I really appreciate you taking out the time to hop on to the Stirring the Pot podcast. If is anything you would like to, if you would like to tell people about your book, if you know, like you said, with networking, if you would like to offer any kind of services, now will be the time to do it.
Absolutely.
You go ahead and let people know where they can find you.
Yep. You can find me at guywhoknowsaguy.com. So the book is called The Guy Who Knows a Guy, which you can find on Amazon. You can also just go to guywhoknowsaguy.com. There's a link to get the book there. There's also a link to my calendar. So if you want to set up a call, I think right now there's like 2 appointments open in December. So because I'm pretty booked up, because that's happens to me network a lot. But I'm happy to talk. But my attitude is I'll give anyone half an hour. So
there you go.
Yeah, whether it's just like, hey, Michael, I want free advice. Give me half an hour of free advice. I'm never going to pay you. Come on in. Happy to help. If it's, you know, I might be interested in your program. Great. If you want some introductions, there's people you're looking to find. If you're like, hey, I want to call BS on that. I can find the person I need. Good. Give me half an hour. I'll teach you how to do it.
Wow.
You're going to have to do it. But I'll talk to anyone. Anyone who's willing to actually do the work and change their life, I'll give them the steps. You got to do the work. There's going to be work involved. It's going to take hours.
Yeah.
Some of it's going to not be fun and be a little uncomfortable. But, you know, if you want to change your life's probably not that comfortable either. So, you know, I can give you the steps. That's easy. Then you just got to do it. So, but yeah, go to guywhoknowsaguy.com. There's a link there to my calendar. So my other information, my podcast is on there, my blog, you know, various other fun things as well. So that is the place to go. Guywhoknowsaguy.com.
Guywhoknowsaguy.com. Michael, like I said, I appreciate you. You've been an awesome guest to the Stirring the Pot podcast, my man. I hope you enjoy the rest of your night. I hope I didn't take up anyone else's time on your calendar.
No, this would be great. All you.
But we really appreciate you here, man. And you're always welcome to be a guest. If you ever say, yeah, you know, I want to just spill something your way. Hey, we can do it, my man. We can definitely do it.
Sounds good. All right, yeah, this was fun. I'm always doing business things. I got to be like, I'm talking about business, or we're not going to talk about politics. We're not going to talk about current events. I don't want to upset anybody. I'm like, all right, I'm going on Gary's show. I'm going to piss everyone off.
Exactly. But,
you know, if you're far left or far right and you just heard me, you're like, that guy's... Some people heard me and thought I was conservative, and some people heard me and thought I was liberal.
Hey, man, listen, man. You have
and hopefully
a good
your
night.
Fans are kind of in the middle and actually think about, you know, realize it's not about the ends, it's about the center.
There you go, man. Hey, man, you ever need anything from us over here, we got your back.
All right, great, man. Oh, yeah, this is fun.
You have a good night. We appreciate you. Peace. Well, there you have it, everybody. This was a different kind of episode with Stirring the Pot podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed the insight. I hope you guys enjoyed the dialogue, the conversation with me and Michael. It was truly awesome. I really, really enjoyed his point of view. Like I said, he gave you his information. Listen, this episode will be live tomorrow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, any podcast platform, you can find us there. Also, Michael has a podcast. So if you wanted to check him out, you can check him out. Go to his website. You'll find all his information over there. And I hope you guys have a great night. I hope you be safe. Take the information with a grain of salt. If you have any questions, you can always inbox me. I'm sure I can get a message to Michael if you wanted to ask him a question. And we'll take it from there. So with that being said, I want to thank you all for tuning in tonight, giving me your ear once again at the Stirring the Pot podcast. You guys have a great night. Peace.